very happy Thanksgiving to you all on this Thanksgiving Day 2013. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce, along with Ray Schwab. Ray, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving, John.
And where are you spending the rest of your Thanksgiving Day?
I will be spending the rest of my Thanksgiving out in New York with my family. I have a long drive ahead of me.
Wonderful, wonderful. What part of New York?
Out in Long Island.
Mm-hmm. Can't get there from here. That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
From the Lehigh Valley to Long Island, it's a challenge, isn't it?
How about you, John?
I am going to be down in New Jersey. I'll be just a little bit south of Toms River, and we're going to have a celebration on there, with family.
Very nice.
Grandchildren, and it's a good thing. Our guest today is Dr. Jack Treadway, and we're going to be speaking about political science, about what's going on in Pennsylvania politics. Very interesting topic to us all. Jack, where are you going to be spending the rest of your Thanksgiving Day?
We will be spending it in Leesport at our daughter's with our grandchildren.
Not too far. Is it still in the Lehigh Valley?
It is not in the Lehigh Valley, but you can see the Lehigh Valley from there, so it's okay.
You can see it. That sounds like a Sarah Palin quote. Huh? Dr. Jack Treadway, a good man and somebody I have known for probably 40 years. It's a church connection that we have. Jack Treadway is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Kutztown University. He's taught there for 35 years and recently retired. Is that right, Jack?
Correct.
And how long have you been retired?
Actually, it's been 5 years now since I've been retired.
Time passes quickly when you're having fun in retirement,
and it doesn't go any slower when you get older, no.
He served 6 years as Department Chairman of Political Science, earned his PhD at the University of Kansas, is the author of two books, Public Policymaking in America and Elections in Pennsylvania, A Century of Partisan Conflict in the Keystone State. Has served as a member of the Kutztown School Board and 5 years as a member of the Minor Judiciary Education Board. That's a long title. Appointed by Chief Justice Ron Castile. He has served 10 years as a member of the Berks County Board of Assistants, currently serving as chairman. He was appointed to the board by Governor Rendell. His wife, Bonnie, and he have a son and daughter and two grandsons. And as I understand it, I'm just going to take a wild guess here, Jack, that Bonnie is probably a nickname for Bonita.
Yes, it is.
Is that? How many Bonitas do you think there are in Pennsylvania?
Probably a reasonable number.
Ray is going to Google that for us immediately and find out.
I'll get back to you.
So you and Bonnie have a son and a daughter. Your son lives far away.
Yes, he lives in Seattle.
What does he do?
He is an artist, and he's working for a video company out there doing artwork for them.
So it makes sense that he's in the Great Northwest doing that kind of work, huh?
There. Yes, he loves it. And he does a lot of rock climbing, so it's a perfect area for him.
Beautiful. And your daughter is in?
She lives in Leesport with her husband and our two grandsons, and she's a speech pathologist at Lehigh Valley Hospital.
And you told me off the air that speech pathology is a hot ticket these days.
Oh, absolutely is, yes. Everyone's looking for speech pathologists. Anyway, and unfortunately, there are an increasing number of children who have speech problems, and it's becoming a real growing field, not just for young people. She works with elderly stroke victims and so on. But especially in the schools, it's unfortunately, as I said, becoming a real problem.
Now, Ray, both Jack and I are Midwesterners. Jack is from Milwaukee, and I'm from the Chicago area. So,
oh, wow.
You have to represent the Great Northeast here.
I think I'll be a good representative.
A great representative.
We'll be the judge of that.
I don't want you guys teaming up on me at all this hour.
We promise not to. So let's get into the topic of our conversation here with Dr. Jack Treadway, and start off by talking about Well, first of all, Jack, let's talk about your own background and how you became interested in political science. First of all, your undergraduate and then graduate studies.
I went to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and I had a double major in history and political science. Liked them pretty much equally well, didn't know what I wanted to do. So I applied to graduate schools in both, and I got an assistantship at Arizona State in history. So I went there and got my master's degree in history, but realized that I really wanted political science. And I got a fellowship then at the University of Kansas for that. So that I got my PhD there.
Right. So you were a Sun Devil and then you were a Jayhawk.
A Jayhawk. That's right.
And what were you at Whitewater?
A warrior at Whitewater.
Jack covers the waterfront. We're talking a lot nowadays, and of course it's in the news every time you turn on any program that's talking about politics, is the partisan stalemate at the national level. Now, that's where we hear about it. We don't hear so much about the state level, Jack, but is it going on in Pennsylvania also?
It's going on in both. Yeah, we're hearing more about it at the national level, as you just said, obviously, because you get more coverage of national politics. And it has become a real problem over the last decade or so. What's happened, particularly at the national level, is a couple of things. You know, one, the parties have simply become more homogenous. You go back a few decades, when you and I were in graduate school, for example, you had that very conservative wing of the Democratic Party in the South, and then the more liberal Northern faction. And you had a more moderate faction of Republicans here in the Northeast, what you might call Rockefeller Republicans, the original Governor Scranton, William Scranton in Pennsylvania. Well, the parties have lost those two more extreme wings, and I'm using extreme just not in a derogatory sense, but I mean ideologically. Most of those, virtually all of those Southern seats, those conservative seats that were held by Democrats, are now Republican seats, making the Republican Party, you know, much more internally consistent. As well as the Democrats, and then the moderates have pretty well disappeared here in the Northeast for the Republicans. So you have a Republican Party that's increasingly conservative, a Democratic Party that's increasingly moderate. No one's a liberal anymore. And so, but by losing those two factions that were a little bit out of step with the rest of the party, again, they become more internally consistent, which makes one party more consistently conservative, the other more consistently liberal. And you're seeing more straight party votes in Congress today. You know, we talk about a party vote being one where a majority of Democrats vote against a majority of Republicans. And that's becoming more commonplace. So you have two parties now that don't have the internal ideological divisions. And as a result, when these issues come up, you know, they're really on different sides of them. And that's also mirrored among voters. You know, voters may say that they don't like this, but they're becoming just as divided as the elected officials are. Pretty much today, if you are a moderate or a liberal, you're a Democrat. If you're a conservative, you are a Republican. We don't have quite as many independents as we did. You know, beginning in the late 60s to the late 70s, you had a terrific growth in the number of independents. Then beginning in 1980, you began to see a rise of partisanship, not back to the levels of the 50s and 60s, but increasing. And so the electorate's as divided as the elected officials are now. And you see that. I mean, just look at the call-in shows that you get, letters to the editor on these issues. I mean, they're here. I mean, there's not much middle ground anymore, which is, I think, a problem.
Right, and so much of what we listen to and on the radio and see on television is entertainment. And so what's entertaining is people shouting at each other or bad-mouthing the other side rather than having civil discourse the way we're doing here.
Right.
it seems as if this has really burgeoned in the media recently, the last decade or so.
And absolutely, yeah. Both on radio and television. I mean, you have people who are extremely conservative, others who are extremely liberal, that have shows on either television or radio. And obviously they're playing to a particular constituency. Their objective views are not their goal. They're preaching to people who are strongly committed to their beliefs.
And my hunch is that people who are leaning toward either left or right, when they listen to these broadcasts, are going to go for the broadcasts that back up their own point of view. They're not looking for, let's see if the other side maybe has some good points to make.
No.
Yep. Now this environment is pretty much all that I'm used to. This is all I've seen on television and in politics. What led up to this? How did this happen?
That's a good question. That's a very interesting point. With younger people have grown up in this environment. That's right. And Ray, the other thing is the technology is so different. I mean, in your lifetime as opposed to John and mine. I mean, you're growing up with a whole different set of information sources just in general. That's a good question. Again, the transformation of the parties that I talked about is part of it. John mentioned, you know, civil discourse. It just isn't as civil. Ray, I wish I had a great answer for you. That's a problem. I'm not sure exactly how we got to this point, but becoming, again, more ideologically extreme is part of it. I mean, we used to talk about politics being the art of compromise. I think now it's the art of confrontation. We're not going to give in. I mean, compromise used to be seen as not just the ideal, but it was just the way we operate. Okay, we stake out a position on this side and they on the other side, and we end up somewhere in the middle and we resolve it. But today, the view of a lot of these more extreme, and again, I'm not using it as a derogatory word, I'm just saying at the more extreme ends of the spectrum ideologically, if we give in on anything, that's capitulation. We're not giving in.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
And if we lose, okay, we lose, but doggone it, we're not going to give up on our ideology.
All or nothing.
That's right.
I think that's an interesting point that you make, Jack, that the word compromise is the way we have dealt. If you take a look at 19th century U.S., that's the way we got through our problems and our many difficult moments, was by respecting the other side and realizing I can't have all that I want. I'll take half a loaf. I'll give him half a loaf, and somehow we'll come to an agreement on what our law is going to be, what our policy is going to be. Now it seems as if the word compromise is you're defecting.
Yeah, half a loaf is seen as a defeat today. And you're seeing a lot of moderates leaving both Congress and state legislatures. I mean, you can't lose people like Senator Bayh from Indiana or, you know, Olympia Dukakis, Senator Collins, Senator Snow, Olympia Snow is what I meant to say, I'm sorry. You can't lose people like that without it damaging the system. These were people who would lead compromise. I mean, there still are people there, but fewer and fewer. And at both the state and national level, you're seeing over the last few years more and more members retiring, just saying, I can't deal with this anymore. No one will compromise. I'm frustrated. I'm beating my head against the wall, and I just can't take it. You'll hear legislators say, a few decades ago, we'd argue, as you were just saying, on the floor. We'd fight these battles, and then we'd go out for drinks and dinner afterwards. No one's going out for drinks and dinner afterwards now. I mean, that carries over off the floor. So I think that, again, right, how exactly we got there, it's hard to pinpoint, at least for me. But it's just the whole environment is different. It's more hostile.
We're chatting with Dr. Jack Treadway, Professor Emeritus from Kutztown University, about politics this evening on our Thanksgiving show here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. John Pierce and Ray Schwab with you. And we're very happy to have Jack with us. Jack, I've been thinking about having an interview with you for a couple of years now, and we finally got it put together. So I'm delighted. We've been talking about partisanship in the national scene. Is it happening in Pennsylvania as well?
Yes, it is. I mean, and not just in Pennsylvania. I mean, obviously, that's our focus. But across the country, it's happening in state legislatures as well. As I just said, you're seeing members of state legislatures as well leaving, just citing the frustration. Right now, you have a Republican governor with a Republican legislature, and he's having a difficult time getting things passed.
That would seem to contradict what we're saying about partisanship, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. But there are some divisions within the Republican Party that are causing him some problems. You're right. It's not the typical situation, but I'm saying even in that situation, it's becoming difficult.
Right.
But yeah, and it is. And the latest poll showed just 11% of Pennsylvanians had a positive view of the job performance of the Pennsylvania legislature. Of course, Governor Corbett's numbers aren't a whole lot better than that. I mean, his are at historic lows, too. But 56% of the voters said they'd like to see most of the incumbents defeated in the next election. But so there's a negative view, but you have to be careful about those numbers when they start talking about wanting incumbents to be defeated, because there has always been a very interesting dichotomy among voters in terms of how they view the legislature. I mean, Congress more, because we see more polls about Congress, of course, than we do about the state legislature. But, historically, they've had a very negative view of Congress or the state legislature, but they tend to like their own legislator. And the most recent poll showed, 46% approved of the job their member of Congress was doing, 41% disapproved. So those numbers are much better.
That's almost half and half.
Yeah. But what's interesting is they like their own member for the same reason they hate the institution. Why do they hate the institution? Well, too much special interest and all these wasteful expenditures, and they're building these roads and these post offices and military bases and, just wasting my money. Why do you like your legislator? Well, he got that transportation money to pave the roads. We got the new post offices. There's a new military base. So they love their person for the same reason they hate the other 434.
That's interesting. I also suspect that on the local level, it's easier to have met the representative and sort of get almost a feeling that you are friendly with that person. You see the person at a certain get-together where you can actually shake hands with him or her. You might see the person at church and so on, meaning that you feel a rapport with that local representative. And so, therefore, you're sort of torn between maybe I don't even like what his position is, but he's a good guy.
Yeah. What's interesting there is you're exactly right. You know the people running for office better. You understand the issues. You have a greater stake in local politics. But it's the area of politics that draws the least interest. I mean, yes, we get more coverage nationally and statewide than local, but voters are the least interested in local politics.
Isn't that interesting?
But you're also, but John, just picking up on our theme here, what you're seeing increasingly at the local level, whether it's school board or city council, borough council, is more and more candidates running with agendas. I mean, for example, in the old days, you would run for the school board because you felt you could help improve the district. Now you're seeing more and more candidates running who want to stick it to the teachers' unions, want to change the curriculum, want to get basketball coaches fired or whatever. There are just more and more agendas, and voters who like those agendas are electing them. To me, that's troubling as well.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Our guest is Dr. Jack Treadway, and we will be back in 60 seconds.
You're listening to WDIY, Community Public Radio for the Lehigh Valley. If you appreciate and value the programming we provide, including NPR's in-depth news coverage, our local public affairs programs, and the diverse mix of music we broadcast each day, please consider becoming a member. Membership is our most important source of revenue. We can't do it without you. You can make a secure donation online at wdiy.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're speaking this evening with Dr. Jack Treadway. We're wishing you all a very, very happy Thanksgiving, hoping that you can be with family and or friends at this time of the year. John Pierce, along with Ray Schwab. Jack, we were talking about the divisions in government, and you just mentioned something off the air. Let's.
Well, I was just picking up on the question that Ray asked about, how do we get to this point and some of the changes that have taken place. One of the other things that's happened in recent decades is you've seen the rise of single-issue groups. I mean, abortion and gun control would be obvious examples, but there are plenty of others as well. And what is happening is that you're seeing more and more voters making their voting choice based on one issue rather than a range of issues. Again, John, over our lifetimes, we're more used to voters saying, well, the candidate is right on this one. He's not so good on this. I'm not crazy about this. Yeah, he's all right on this one. I think I'll vote for him. Now, he's wrong on abortion. I'm not voting for him. He's right on gun control. I'm voting for him or whatever the issue is. And that makes it difficult for candidates as well. I mean, if you're a candidate dealing with all of those, it's difficult because you have a whole segment of the electorate making up their mind on one issue, on whether they're going to vote for you or not. And that's difficult.
And you also mentioned school boards before. And let's talk a little bit about your experience, because you have been on a school board for how many years?
For 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And and that was which school district?
Yeah, Kutztown School District.
And are there term limits on the board?
No, there aren't at that level. It's an interesting experience. You try to do the best that you can do to improve things. But even there, it's interesting to see. It was interesting for me, maybe as just because I'm a political scientist, to see the response of the citizens to issues. Now, for the most part, you didn't have a whole lot of people attending school board session. I mean, the typical school board session, there isn't a whole lot going on, and pretty much nobody shows up. When there's something that's controversial, you'll get more people. But what you find, and I'm sure that this would be true for people on borough councils, city councils as well. The people who are opposed to you show up. The people who like what you're doing rarely come.
Right.
So generally, if it's a controversial issue, you're facing a hostile group. Because again, the people who support you figure, well, we're happy with what they're doing. There's no need to come out. But the people who are against you come out. And it's difficult because those people can make accusations and you can't really respond. I mean, sometimes you can't respond because it's a personnel issue. You can't speak to it. Or if it involves minors, you can't speak to a lot of issues. And I don't mean to suggest that we dealt with that many controversial issues. But you can't talk back. I mean, they can even use bad language and so on. You just pretty well have to take it, because if you respond, the headline the next day is going to be school board member attacks, member of the audience. That's a difficult part, because what they're saying in some cases, I'm saying in some cases, isn't accurate, but you can't set the record straight because of confidentiality reasons.
Right. Well, part of it is just not taking things personally, too. this person is really ticked off about something. I understand that, and I happen to be on the other side of that issue from this person. I'm voting the way he would not want me to vote, and yet that's my job. That's what I have to do as school board member.
Yeah, there was one other thing that it troubles me, not just as a board member, but I'm not a board member now. It still troubles me. When issues come up, again, whether it's a school board or a city council, and they're going to set up some kind of a committee to look into something, and someone invariably now say, well, there should be some people from the public sitting on this board. Well, there are. They're the elected board members. They represent the public, which is kind of, I mean, to me, if you want, I mean, citizens should always should come in and voice their opinion. That's the way it ought to work. But some people would like a little bit more impact. My feeling is, well, then get elected to the board. Because it's easy to take shots in the audience. You can make suggestions, but you don't have to take any responsibility for it. You don't have to implement it. If you're an elected official, you do have to take responsibility. That's a significant difference to me. So, I mean, again, it makes it sound like I don't like the public involved. No, the public should be involved, obviously. It just sometimes I just want to say, well, if you're that interested, then why don't you get on board, get elected, help shape the policy, and then as a consequence, then deal with the repercussions of it.
Right, and your comment about the fact that the public's input into whatever the issue is taken into account because you are board members from the public who have been elected, and the public may very well take the stance it's them and us. In other words, the school board, them, and the public, us. So kind of a bad-good relationship, which is really too bad.
Yes, it is. And again, getting back to Ray's point, that was one of the other things that I saw. This was in the mid-90s, not all that long ago. The distrust, even at the school board level, you were talking about the local board knowing people and so on. There was an issue regarding whether schools were going to be closed down and that sort of thing, and they weren't. But we held hearings at a variety of schools and had no idea what we were going to do. But there were people at each meeting, well, I know that this is just a charade. You've already made up your mind. And I thought, boy,
right.
If you knew how disorganized we were at the moment. But this was
a case of having to close schools because not enough of a juvenile population.
And that's right. And it turned out that they weren't. But my point is that distrust had gotten down to that level, which I found disturbing. I thought, my goodness, even in a relatively small rural school district, you have people who distrust elected officials. That's troubling.
Now, in this kind of environment, though, with that partisanship and with this distrust from the public, what can be achieved?
That's a good question. That's the tricky part. I mean, obviously, things can still be achieved, but boy, it gets hard.
Yeah.
But you know, part of this problem today, Ray, with the partisanship is neither party wants to give the other party credit. So, I mean, let this just take and both parties are equally guilty. I mean, so at the Pennsylvania level, I mean, the Democrats don't want Governor Corbett to get credit for anything good that happens. At the national level, the Republicans don't want President Obama to get credit for anything that's going to be positive. So you get the sense that they'd rather not solve the problem than give the other party credit for it. And that makes it very difficult to do things right. I mean, historically, what we've always said is that you need strong leadership, which typically meant the executive had to provide the leadership. Today, I think you can have the strong leadership and still not necessarily be guaranteed you're going to solve the problem. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Keep going.
When you were back to the school board idea, Jack, because that's a local way that people can participate if they're really interested in government. One way is to become a member of a board. It could be a city council or a county council or school board, and have something to say and a way to sort of shape what's going to happen. Did you ever have a meeting that was an overflow crowd that you had to move it to another place?
No, we never had, when I was on the board, we never had an issue that was that big. I mean, clearly there are right now in some of the districts, but particularly with all these budget cuts that have to be made. Those are very difficult decisions that have to be made.
Right. How much time would you say the school board spends on budget matters versus everything else? Is it a huge amount?
Yeah, it is. It's hard to put a percentage on, but yeah, that tends to overwhelm almost everything else. And clearly that is significant in everything else. I mean, okay, maybe we're not formally putting the budget together, but if we're talking about expanding programs or adding curricula or contracting or whatever it may be, it's budget driven, so that the budget permeates all of that. Yeah, it's a difficult process. The other thing that I would tell listeners is whether it's the state level, you know, the local level, this notion that all we have to do is cut the fat, I don't think is true in most cases. There's not that much fat left to be cut.
Kind of cutting especially into the bone at this point.
Yeah, especially at school districts, you know, boroughs and so on. There's not a lot of waste there that can be eliminated. It's not that simple.
Right. It sounds easy to say. It is easy to say, and may not be the case. Jack, we're speaking with Dr. Jack Treadway today on Lehigh Valley Discourse about things political. Do you see our current stalemate in Congress as being a momentary thing that maybe in a few years we can get out of? And is there any way to know about that? crystal ball?
It's hard to foresee. I mean, in the short term, I just don't see it changing. I mean, given the divisions, as I said, in the parties with the voters, the other problem that ties into this, obviously not for the Senate, they run statewide, but for representatives, well, in both houses at the state level and the U.S. House, is the gerrymandering factor. I mean, these districts have become so safe for parties, not just members, but for parties, it's going to be tough to overturn that. I mean, so districts that are electing Republicans now are going to be electing Republicans for some time, Democrats. I mean, I realize, you know, at the beginning of the next decade, you'll get a chance to redistrict. But these districts have just been made so safe, it's hard for the other party to have a chance in most of them.
So that's gerrymandering.
Yeah, gerrymandering means just creating districts. Well, there's a couple of types. Partisan is the one you hear most about. That would be creating districts that are safe for your party and make it difficult for the other party to win. But what you see as well in a lot of the states, particularly if there's divided control, the governor is from one party, the legislature is from the other, or one house of the legislature is controlled by one party, the other the opposite party, is what we call incumbent gerrymandering, where they just protect incumbents from each party. Because, you know, they can't push through a purely partisan gerrymandering because the other party has enough votes to defeat that, or the governor does. But they just protect – we have a history of that in Pennsylvania, just protecting each other's incumbents, making them increasingly safe. And that's a problem here in Pennsylvania. We have so many districts that are so safe – for one party or the other. What I found when I was doing the research for the book is at least 60% of the voters were registered with the dominant party in 55% of the House districts and 50% of the Senate districts. We talk about 60% margins meaning being a safe district. We talk about safe versus marginal districts. Safe meaning the legislator won with at least 60%, marginal meaning less than that. Well, you know, over half of the districts are safe just in terms of partisan registration, meaning the other party doesn't have much chance. I mean, if you're the minority party candidate in the district that's 60-40 in favor of the other party, pretty tough for you to win.
Though not impossible.
No, it happens. But I'm just saying, that's what's happening in so many of these districts. And congressional districts, the same thing. They're just so safe for the party, it's really almost impossible for the party to lose that seat.
Jack, years ago, I remember political ads putting the parties, either Democrat or Republican, usually, in the forefront and vote Democrat, vote Republican, and then putting the image of the person up there and whatever the position was going to be. I've noticed recently that sometimes the party doesn't even appear in the ad.
Very good point. Most of the time today it doesn't. Just look at campaign literature that you get, or maybe if you have some from the last campaign or the next one, even for things like senator or governor. Yeah, that's right. It'll have the candidate's face, but it rarely does it mention party, if ever. You're right. So it's more vote for me as opposed to the party.
Right, which seems sort of contradictory in our discussion about how we're polarized. And is it a polarization Democrat-Republican, or is it more of a polarization of ideology?
Well, both, because, again, I mean, it's partisan. But the Republicans are party is so conservative, the Democratic Party is so moderate, that the ideology goes right along with it today. I mean,
right.
But why wouldn't you put your party's name on? Well, your party members know if you're a Republican or a Democrat anyway, and you're trying to broaden your appeal, because there are a number of voters, obviously, who don't know the partisanship of candidates. It might see it and say, oh, okay, that appeals to me. I could vote for him or I could vote for her.
Right. Does it make sense in Pennsylvania in your view? And I'll tell you what my view is. I'll tell you whether you're right or wrong on this,
okay,
answer, Jack. This is a little quiz. Does it make sense for a person to be to declare him or herself as independent?
I don't think it does. No. I mean, it does if you just say, that's my view and I'm going to stand up for it, and I will register independent, register nonpartisan. I'm quite sure I know where you're going. The consequence is, though, you can't vote in the primary, because you have to be a registered Republican or Democrat. It's a closed primary here in Pennsylvania.
Exactly my point.
I mean, yeah.
And whether you really want – if you wanted to defeat the other side, you could declare yourself one party, even though your feelings are not that way. But then you can vote against the people –
That's correct. Yeah.
I mean, you could use it negatively.
Yeah, I mean, right. As an independent, if I'm registered independent, I can, let's say, you're right, I don't like the Democratic candidate, I could register Democratic and go in and vote for somebody else in the primary, sure. But that takes a lot of work, more work than most people are willing to put out.
Right. And most people are going to declare themselves, of course, according to their philosophy.
But just talking about, you know, growing up in Wisconsin, where I grew up, they've always had open primaries, meaning any registered voter can vote in either party's primary. But here in Pennsylvania, it's always been a closed primary. So, yes, you're right. I mean, you give up that right to vote in the primary.
Jack, that was the correct answer. That was my answer.
Oh, that's
a
relief.
It took me years to convince my wife. A shout out to Bonnie. Oh, that's another thing we have in common, Ray. We're Midwesterners and both married to a Bonnie.
Wow.
So she was independent because why? Because that is the way I feel. I don't want to align myself with either Republicans or Democrats. And then so I kept saying to her, but that means you cannot vote in primary elections. Maybe she didn't want to vote in primary elections. But finally she came around and she declared so. I'll leave it a mystery which one
probably
she
declared. Just to shut you up.
Great point. We are having some fun here today with Dr. Jack Treadway on Thanksgiving Day and enjoying our interview about politics. Can you believe enjoying an interview about politics, Jack? It's a first. Right here on WDIY Allentown. Time to take a break. We'll be back in 60 minutes. 60 seconds.
60 minutes.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. For more information, visit wdiy.org.
A very happy Thanksgiving to you all. And Dr. Jack Treadway is with us for a few more minutes. We're talking about politics today. He's a professor emeritus from Kutztown University, retired 5 years ago. Happily retired, Jack, I see.
Yes.
Yes, and he is also, Ray, I should mention, Dapper Dan. He even gets teased on occasion because his socks match the little bit of handkerchief that comes out of the jacket pocket.
Really?
I mean, yes. Now, you wouldn't believe that today, but we're on the radio. He understood that. So, Jack, good for you for being a sharp dresser. We want to talk a little bit now about some proposed changes to the political system in general and in Pennsylvania in particular. Jack, what do we have as far as proposals are concerned?
Well, off the air, you mentioned term limits. You might as well start with that one. That has been popular the last couple of decades. 21 states adopted term limits for state legislators, roughly the same adopted term limits for Congress. The Supreme Court struck down the term limits for Congress, saying, in effect, you have to amend the Constitution to do that. But there were 21 that adopted it for state legislators. 15 still have them, 6 no longer do. In 4 of the state Supreme Court struck them down. In 2 of them, the legislature repealed it. Generally, they were proposed by citizens through an initiative, meaning you're able to circulate a proposed law or constitutional amendment. You have to get a certain number of signatures on the petition. It's typically expressed as a percentage of the total vote for governor in the last election. Once you get them, the proposal goes on the ballot in a referendum, and then voters get to vote yes or no. These were predominantly Western states because that's where the initiative and referendum are most common. And basically, these were all done through the initiative. Just to me, another example of the frustration voters had with the system, because I did research on these states, looking at the level of competition, the turnover of state legislators previously, a number of other factors. They really were no different from the states that didn't adopt term limits, with the exception of the presence of the initiative. In other words, voters could do this. They could take out their frustration by imposing term limits. Sometimes the limits are the number of consecutive years you can serve. Sometimes it's a lifetime term limit. 8 years is the most common. And the sense is that this will turn over the legislature, get new ideas. It will do away with professional politicians, which a lot of people think are bad, get back to the citizen legislator notion.
Which was the way the founding fathers envisioned the way government would work.
Personally, I don't like term limits. Well, now, I should mention we've never had them in Pennsylvania, also don't have the initiative here. So in Pennsylvania and states that don't have the initiative, clearly then this proposal would have to come from the legislature, and that's not likely to happen. They're not likely to term limit themselves. I think, first of all, it's undemocratic. It denies voters the opportunity to vote for a particular candidate. You lose institutional memory. People who've been around for a while and remember why something worked or didn't, it avoids repeating past mistakes. You lose a lot of expertise. You have to remember, too, that good legislators leave right along with the bad legislators. I mean, there's no question in every legislature you have legislators who are walking endorsements for term limits. But you have a lot that I would assume most people don't want to lose. Well, you lose them as well. You also give administrators and interest groups a greater say because they stay around while the legislature turns over.
Who stays around?
The special interest groups, the lobbyists, the administrators, and the various agencies stay there, and they're dealing with new people who don't know the system quite as well.
They are really our systematic government, aren't they?
Yeah,
the people that we're not electing.
Day to day, they're running.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I personally don't like term limits, but they've been extremely popular with voters. They generally pass by pretty good margins. But some of the states now are beginning to see that there are problems. Again, they're losing legislative leadership. They're beginning to see that they lose expertise. I understand the argument against professional politicians, why some people are opposed to that, but we're in an era where things are becoming much more technological, much more sophisticated, and I'm not sure that it's easy for citizen legislators to just come in and pick that up. I mean, I think you have to be around for a while to understand a lot of these complicated issues. So,
well, and term limits were not put into our original Constitution. So obviously the Founding Fathers did not feel that it was necessary to, but neither was the limit on the presidency,
yeah, well,
which came in much later.
Yeah, it's interesting. Originally, there were term limits in most state most of the original state constitutions for governors. In a number of cases, 1 year terms. But for legislators, no, that came around later. And of course, we do have term limits for the president now.
Correct.
After
FDR.
That's correct.
And in fact, somebody said that it was kind of ironic that that law was passed under the Eisenhower administration, and then in 1960, wouldn't the Republicans have liked to put Ike up again for
term? Just to piggyback, I was going to say you're right. And after that, Ronald Reagan, who probably could have been elected for third term. So it's interesting. Yeah, the Republicans were so upset about Roosevelt, but the two people who probably have gotten caught. Well, I think Bill Clinton, even though he was controversial, was pretty popular. But, right. I mean, Eisenhower and Reagan were two people who were caught in that.
Yeah. Right. So do you agree with the term limit on the presidents?
I don't like term limits, period. I just think we ought to let voters decide these things.
Okay. I guess part of the idea is just not having one person become so powerful that we go to a really
right.
very, very strong presidential system, as they do have in some countries.
Let's just take it down the state level. The argument I used to use in class was, you're right, John, that's the argument that, well, we don't want people to become too strong. But let's say I'm a term-limited governor. I know I can't run again. If I'm predisposed to do things that you'd associate with someone who was power-hungry and so on, wouldn't I be more likely to do it if I didn't have to face the voters again than if I had to come back? So I'm not sure that argument works. I think people who are prone to do those kinds of things might be more emboldened by the fact that they don't have to run again. But that's the argument. You're right. But anyway, but term limits would be one. One of the other proposals we're hearing a lot about these days in Pennsylvania is reducing the size of the state legislature. This is the second largest legislature in the country. We have 100 senators, or 50 senators, I'm sorry, and 203 representatives, you know, 253 members. The largest is New Hampshire, which has 424 members.
That's amazing. Yeah,
which means pretty much every other person in New Hampshire's a member of the legislature.
I was thinking California, New York, the populous states.
Here the five states that are larger than Pennsylvania. California has 120 legislators. I'm talking about both houses now. Texas, 181. New York, 213. Florida, 160. And Illinois, 177. So this is outside of New Hampshire, this is the largest state legislature. We also have the largest number of staff for any legislature, roughly 3,000 staffers in Harrisburg. And the salary is second only to California, a little under 84,000. So people look at that and say, well, we have this large legislature, larger than states even bigger than us. We have too many staff. We have the salary. We could save a lot of money. You wouldn't save all that much money. The estimate is about 1% of the budget. Okay, I mean, I realize it comes to what looks like a reasonable sum of money, but you wouldn't save all that much money.
The $84,000 in Pennsylvania represents money for whom?
That's the annual salary for legislators. Now, if you're a committee chair or a party leader, it's more than that. And then, of course, there's the car lease and per diem, but that's just the base salary.
Another interesting thing that I found out in the state capitol is that the offices of legislators vary in size and elegance. according to seniority.
Oh, Congress, the same thing. Yes, right. Yeah, yeah, the more powerful you become, the better office you get. Absolutely.
And perhaps more staff. I don't know that for sure. But
yes.
I would encourage all Pennsylvanians at some point to go and just take a walk through the House of Representatives. Do we call it the House of Representatives?
Yes.
In Pennsylvania. Beautiful room. One of the most beautiful rooms
fantastic.
I ever
it's
saw.
Gorgeous. And the Senate chamber is even more gorgeous. It's spectacular.
I haven't seen the Senate chamber.
So there's a call to reduce that. And most voters like the idea in theory. This, again, I think is one of those where when it gets down to practice, everyone isn't going to be as excited as they are in theory. Okay, let's say that we're going to reduce the size of the House by 50 or 60. Which 50 or 60? I mean, who goes?
Would you have to redistrict the whole state?
Then you have to redistrict the whole state. Each legislator clearly would represent more people. You'd have less contact with legislators. I mean, I'm not trying to make the argument one or another. I'm just saying these are things that certainly would come up. But I may be someone who just says, absolutely, this is outrageous. Let's throw 50 or 60 of these people out. But if it's my representative whom I like, I might say, oh, no, I'm not sure about that. But that's one of the things. I'm not sure it's very likely to happen. You'd have to amend the Constitution, which means that there'd have to be a proposal that would pass the state legislature in two different sessions, with an election in between, and then it would have to be approved by the voters in a referendum. So I'm not sure that the legislature is going to pass that.
Why would it have to be voted on in two separate sessions?
Because that's the process for amendments in Pennsylvania. It has to pass two different sessions of the legislature and then be approved by the voters. So reducing the size of the legislature is another one that has become extremely popular. Limit the session is another one people are talking about. In other words, not meet as often as they do. The notion would be you'd go back to more of the part-time citizen legislature approach. We're one of four considered professional legislatures. The National Conference of State Legislatures classifies legislatures on the basis of how often they meet and salary and a variety of other things, along with California, Michigan, and New York. But there are people who'd like to go back to a shorter session, not meet nearly as often.
How often do they meet in Pennsylvania?
Well, they can meet for as long as they want in Pennsylvania. There's no real limit.
Don't they have a schedule?
Oh, they have a schedule,
year,
there's no. In some states, you're limited to no more than 30 days or 60 days in session. We don't do that in Pennsylvania. So there are some who would say, well, let's go back to more of the part-time legislature. In a state this size, to me, that would be very difficult to do. I mean, I don't know why you'd want to have a less professional legislature than you have with all the issues that we're dealing with.
So our legislature mirrors the national legislature.
Correct.
In that
yeah.
sense of yeah. the professional. And there are only four states doing that.
Well, I mean, I don't mean that the other 46 are unprofessional. Just Pennsylvania is grouped in the with those three states, in effect, as being the most professional legislators. And there are others behind them. But the point is that we're considered to be one of the most professional in terms of salary and staff and meeting and so on.
Right.
And then the one of the other proposals is to reduce the salary, that the salary is too high. It's usually looked at just in terms of the salary is too high. I think really it's more, there's two separate issues here for me. One, is $84,000 an unreasonable salary for a state legislator? I don't think it is. I mean, given the responsibility, salaries of other people comparable responsibility in the private sector, I don't think it is. But then the second question is your legislator worth $84,000? Now, the answer to that might be no. But, I mean, I don't think you can just say that the salary's too high in general.
I agree with that. It does not seem, in our day, and age, it does not seem to be out of line.
No.
Jack, just a comment. My father was a dentist, and in his best earning years, and those would be in the 40s, 50s, 60s, he earned a gross of $35,000 a year. We were brought up in suburban Chicago, very upper middle class, without being extravagantly wealthy. And that salary of $35,000 was in the top 5% of earners in the whole country.
Yeah. And
in those days.
And you could buy homes for $10,000 or $15,000.
Exactly.
Cars for a couple thousand.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And so everything changes, and $84,000 just doesn't sound like that huge an amount anymore to us.
No.
We have been speaking here this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse with Dr. Jack Treadway. Jack, we appreciate your coming in. Guess what? Our time is up.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Happy Thanksgiving to you all, and we'll look forward to you down the road sometime, somewhere, someplace on Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown. Ray Schwab, thanks so much for your work on the board.
Of course, John.
And a happy Thanksgiving.
And be gentle with your neighbor.